Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Village Center, the speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on blaming the victim. So let's listen in on Chuck.
What the church can provide when it works in its prophetic role, which is to give us social support for disobeying authority that is urging us to do what we consider to be evil. That's the answer to the question you were asking. Sure. Well, what you this your question might not have made it on the tape, so let me just reiterate it, which is, how does this work with hypnotism, where people, even when they're hypnotized, supposedly under the influence of someone else, won't do things that are against their conscience? What you find in those kinds of situations usually is it's just one social pressure, which is the hypnotist saying, act like a chicken, right? And most of us don't want to act like a chicken in public, unless it's at the 4th of July parade. But what's happened in the Milgram situation, and in a lot of the situations in our daily life, is multiple pressures. So the person in the Milgram study, they were being asked to shock the other person, had really two duties. One duty they had to the experimenter, who was saying, do this thing for the good of science, and I promise no permanent damage will happen to this person you're shocking. And the other duty was their duty to the victim, who they didn't want to harm. And that's what produced the tremendous stress that you saw in these people. Many of them sweated, they laughed, they fidgeted a lot in their chairs, they protested a great deal, but they continued to shock while doing all those things. So that first sort of by the way is that I think the church can serve as a means of social support to give us support to not obey commands or situations that we think would produce evil actions. I promise later in about 20 minutes to get directly to the issue of blaming the victim. But I want to lead up to it with some conversation or some talk about our own motivations, because I need to lay that groundwork before we can get to the blaming the victim stuff. First, I wanted to let you know that this questionnaire that you see up in front of you is a thing that we often give to people and ask them simply to agree or disagree with each statement. This time, you don't get to say it depends on the situation. You have to either say yes or no. And there are things, for folks who are on the tape, there are things like, I found that a person rarely deserves the reputation he has. Basically, the world is a just place. People who get lucky breaks have usually earned their fortune. The political candidate who sticks up for his principles rarely gets elected. Crime doesn't pay. So all of these statements are really statements about justice. You know, whether people get what they deserve, whether you get what's coming to you. And we ask people to give us yes or no answers, and we use the questions that are loaded negatively, that is, many people suffer through no fault of their own, and we add those up together, but weighting them negatively with the positive ones, to get a feeling for overall how you feel about whether the world is a just place, whether people get what they deserve. So that's what that scale is, and you need to keep that in the back of your mind as I'm talking about all the rest of this stuff today. I want to start with a very basic need that all of us have, and that is that we all feel a need to be in control of what happens to us. We like to feel like the actions that we do will get us the things we expect. This is not surprising. I mean, there's a great deal of negative affect associated with the phrase, I'm out of control. People who feel out of control don't like it. Precisely the reason we like rides at the circus or at the amusement parks is because it sort of gives you a little bit of that feel of out of control, but you know you're really safe. So we really have at our basic core a need to be in control. Let me argue for this a little bit in more detail rather than simply asserting it, asking you to believe me because I'm the authority. Some fascinating studies have been done comparing people who are clinically depressed with what in our jargon we call normals, which is just us, folks who aren't clinically depressed. Particularly, they have looked at issues of how people who are clinically depressed feel about this critical issue of control. Do they feel like they can control their outcomes? One fascinating study was they had these two different groups of people, clinically depressed people and, quote, normals, unquote, come into a lab and participate in a learning experiment where they had to make decisions, they had to press a button to try to make a green light come on. And there were a couple of other color lights. Well, as you know by now, pretty much all the studies that social psychologists do are sneaky. And what we were doing in this study was putting people in a situation where most of the time their buttons that they pressed had no relation to what light came on. That is, we sort of flipped coins to figure out which light would come on, and they could press whatever the button they wanted, and it didn't matter. And that was about 75% of the time they were, quote, out of control. And about 25% of the time they were in control. Now, here's the fascinating outcome of that study. It was the depressed people who were accurate about whether or not they were in control. And it was the normals, quote, who overestimated their control. Let me do that again. The depressed people felt like were very accurate. They said, oh, yeah, I press buttons and I don't know what happens. Who knows how to control this? Whereas the normals, those of us who had sort of standard healthy responses, were in fact overestimating our control on the world. Here is, I think, a very strong argument to suggest that we really have a need to perceive ourselves as in control, and we will distort the world to think of ourselves as in control, even when we're not. And you can run that little scenario backwards in your head and say, ooh, well, maybe if we think that we're not in control, we'll get depressed. That's actually what happens, and research supports that idea, which is that people who have a style of attribution, we call it attributional style, that suggests to them that they are out of control and that all the things that they do only produce bad outcomes are much more likely to become depressed and to stay depressed. So in fact, one of the things that we often do with people who are depressed is to train them in thinking positively. This is not the standard sort of airheaded thinking positively, but we do train them to try to be positive in their attributions about their ability to control the world. So there's some suggestion, in fact, that it's probably psychologically healthy for us to overestimate the amount of control we have in the world, which is a little weird, and we'll get back to that paradox in a bit. This need for control can really affect our attributions about others, too. Now, with the depressed people, we were talking about their attributions about themselves, right? Am I in control? But our need for control in the world can also affect how we perceive other people. When outcomes from an action are worse, we are more likely to blame the person who produced those outcomes. Let's take an example that should be fresh in most of your minds since you had to get up at 1:30 this morning listening to a fire alarm. If someone at Holden Village drops a match somewhere without putting it out, but it goes out in the sand, it doesn't seem like quite as horrible a thing. But if, in fact, by chance, that match had dropped in a wastebasket or had dropped close to some tinder or had dropped close to the edge of a building, it seems like a much worse thing because the building goes up in flame and we lose it like Chalet 2. So the outcome of an action can make us want to blame the person more, even though the action is precisely the same. Even though the action might be exactly the same action, we're going to want to give more blame to the person if it turns out bad. This is, by the way, related to some of the things we talked about yesterday, for instance, in technological disasters. Gee, it's no big deal if there's a little bit of a leak at the nuclear power plant and nothing goes wrong. But if something goes really horribly wrong, oh gosh, those people should have known. This, by the way, is something psychologists call hindsight bias. Even more to the point of our own defensiveness as we think about other people and whether or not they're to blame for the things that they do, when the person who's in that situation is more like us, or the situation is more like the kinds of situations that we may find ourselves in, we are even more motivated to blame them. Does that make sense? If they're like me, I don't want to think that that could happen to me. So I have to say, well, that person is stupid, but I'm still in control. So we defensively blame them because we want to feel like we're in control of what's going on. Does that scenario work for you? There are times when it might not work. And in fact, usually what we find when it doesn't work is because something has changed about similarity. But in general, you'll find this pattern. Now, just like we as individuals have differences in our desire for food, you can tell by looking at me, we have differences in our desires for control. And that gets us back to this thing up on the screen, which is about really desires for control and how much we think we'll get what we deserve. This scale, by the way, is called the just world scale. And it measures the extent to which people believe in a just world, that in this world you get what you deserve. And there are large differences among people and how much we believe this. I don't want simply, though, to talk about those large differences among ourselves, because I want us all to recognize that we all have this need for control and that none of us wants to think that we have no control at all over our outcomes. So we all have some of it. We all want to eat. Some of us just want to eat more. Right? We all have a desire for control. Some of us just have more of a desire for control. Now, like I promised, let's get to blaming the victim. You can see how this can work out. You can work this scenario out now in your mind. People who are high in their belief in a just world, that is, people who really think that the world is just, are more likely to blame victims for the catastrophes or mishaps that befall them. Because, let's go back to this issue of similarity. If you think it might happen to you, you want to say, oh, that person was stupid, but I would avoid it. So they, in some sense, deserve what happened to them. So, because we have this need for control, we want to blame bad outcomes on somebody, not us. Now, in fact, I'll play with that in a minute. But in general, we find this pattern in the ways people think about people who lose their jobs, as we think about women who have been raped, as we think about people who are poor. We often think that they deserve what they get because they had it coming to them in some way. Now, there are different kinds of ways of talking about how they had it coming to them, and in fact, in one particular instance, it's very important. Let me say, for instance, having said this, you know, I have always said I want to make you think more complexly. Blaming the victim is not always bad. In fact, sometimes it is our stupidity that gets us in trouble. And even if it isn't, sometimes blaming yourself helps you to get better. Now, this is a particularly sensitive issue I want to talk about, so I ask that you listen through all of my sentences before we get done. We have found with victims of rape that if the woman blames herself for the outcome, for the misfortune of rape, she often will get over post-traumatic stress more quickly. Now, let's run that scenario. If she blames herself, it's able for her to get a sense of control back. Whereas if she doesn't blame herself, she never gets her sense of control back. Now, it's a little more complex than that, even. Because there's different kinds of blaming yourself. What we found is that victims of rape who blame their actions, like I shouldn't have gone to that party, or I shouldn't have been in that parking lot, are the ones who are more likely to recover from post-traumatic stress. Victims who blame their character, rape victims who blame their character, do not recover from post-traumatic stress. Right? So it's not just blaming yourself. Well, because look, if you blame your character, well, it's not like you can change that very easily. You've always got that with you. So you will always live in fear again. But if you blame your actions, at least you might be able to change something so that it won't happen in the future. Now, I don't want to claim that these people are right when they blame their actions. I don't want to make that claim. I only want to make the claim that if they blame their actions, they get over post-traumatic stress more quickly. They may not. It may be wrong to blame their actions in terms of fact, because in fact they may have had no control over it, and it might have happened no matter what. But if they blame their actions, then they can take control. They can move out of that neighborhood. They can change their friends. They can stop going to wild parties. They can do something that allows them to assert their control on the world. And they get over this feeling of having lost control more quickly. My bet is that it would be true, but I have no data to tell you that. The only research that I know is post-traumatic is work that's been done with rape victims. So I would not be surprised if it worked with other kind of post-traumatic stress like victims of war in Bosnia. Yes. But you see, in fact, that's what we're talking about. When you say, maybe I need to change the situation, that's precisely what some of these women are doing when they're blaming themselves. They're blaming themselves for putting themselves in that situation, which says to them, let's get out of it. Instead of saying, oh, I deserve to be beaten by my husband. See, and that's a very different kind of attribution, and that keeps you in. I didn't fix his dinner well. I haven't been keeping track of the checkbook very well. I didn't clean the house. I'm a bad person. Now, you'll note that there's some ambiguity in some of the things I just said because some of those things are actions. And in fact, these are the kinds of blame that often keep women in. These, so to say, I didn't clean the house well, they'll go clean the house well and he'll come back and beat her anyway, but he'll blame her for something else. So these things are even more complex than just that one distinction I made between blame for action and blame for character. Oh yes, you would like them. And this is why I say that I'm not trained to help people. I mean, I read the research, and I can talk about the patterns that we find in the research, but folks who are trained to help people know that it's even more complex than these large patterns that we've been able to find in the research, and they're able to work with an individual and say, it might not help this individual if I were to say you should blame your actions. Because the kind of action she might pick would be things like cleaning up the house. And those aren't the ones you wanted to pick. The kind of actions you wanted to pick are things like not leaving. Now, of course, you may not want her to pick that one. Because very often these women are in fear of their lives that the fellow will come after them and kill them. So these things are hugely complex. But there are some patterns that we can use to help us think more carefully about them, and those are the kinds of things I'm trying to talk about today. Not just so we. I don't think it's helpful just to say, "Gosh, the world is complex," and go have a cup of coffee. It's helpful to try to impose some structure on it, and this may be my own need for control. But I think it is helpful for us to try to think of some way that we can try to understand, we can try to parse the situations that we find ourselves and our friends and our colleagues in. I want to make one more sort of controversial claim that is backed up by data. And we're going to have to try to figure out what to do with this. The research shows that the, is that a fly or you want to talk to me? Okay. This is like an auction. If you move, you're in trouble. This is work that's backed up by data. But I think we're going to have to be careful as we try to interpret it. The research shows that the more on average, and this isn't 100% predictive, it's actually about 30% predictive, the more religious a person is, the more likely they are to believe in a just world. I mean, that is what the data show, and we're going to have to try to unpack that a little bit and figure out what it means. But let's take that inference one step further. Right? The more religious a person is, the more likely they are to believe in a just world. The more people believe in a just world, the more likely they are to blame victims. See, I told you it was controversial. I think it does, and in fact, the move we have to make to understand this relationship between being religious and blaming the victim as it's mediated by belief in a just world has to be to think about different kinds of being religious. And that's precisely the kind of move that the social scientists who study the psychology of religion are making. And they're talking about various kinds of being religious. But it is why I always cringe a little when I hear in response to some bad outcome someone saying, well, all things work together for the good. Because if you're not careful when you say that, you can say, well, this should have happened to you. You know, it's easy when you take a verse like that to fall off the edge into saying, it should have happened to you. You deserved it. You didn't have enough faith. I'm sorry, Dave. So your question is how do people define, who doing this research, define being religious? Do they just ask folks, or do they use some other criteria? And the answer is yes. They do all of that. Some of the sort of sloppier work just sorts of asks, we'll just ask folks. And sometimes that's all you can do. But in fact, there is a growth industry in scales of different kinds of being religious. Let me give you just three different dimensions that we have found are in many people's religious approach mixed together, but you can find people who fall on the ends of these dimensions. One is religion as an extrinsic thing. I try to popularize this idea as God as butler. Right? Religion gets you stuff. It gets you eternal life. It gets you joy now. It gets you connections in the community. You go to church because that's what the respectable people do. So this is religion as a means to an end. Another kind of religious approach that people have is an intrinsic approach, and that is religion as an end in itself. This is the desire to be close to God, the desire